Hello, I'm Jeff Watts, and welcome to the 81st edition of Optometric Quarterly. In addition to the CD and Docket website, you can access current and past editions of Optometric Quarterly from your iPhone, iPad, or iPod Touch using our new app. This can be found and downloaded for free by searching Docket in the iTunes Store. And thanks again to those listeners who've completed our survey. You can find it by searching for OQ Survey, by following the links from the Docket website, or by selecting the survey function on the Docket app. Our first interview concerns developments being made in the field of retinal implant technology by the German company Retinal Implant AG, and follows an interview in OQ80 about electrical stimulation therapy as a treatment for retinitis pigmentosa. Deborah Lee will be talking to Professor Robert McLaren of the University of Oxford about the trials he's running of new subretinal implants. It's a pretty lengthy piece, so we've divided it into two parts. Over a quarter of a million people in the UK are registered as visually impaired because of macular disease, with the same number again affected by it to a lesser extent. It's estimated that a further 15,000 people suffer from retinitis pigmentosa. Currently, there are two types of retinal implants showing promise in combating these degenerative diseases. Epiretinal implants, which use an external camera and power sent from an external transmitter, and subretinal implants, which are transplanted behind the retina itself. Founded in 2003, Retinal Implant AG believe their implants can become the first fully functioning electronic retinal prostheses, capable of giving partial sight back to blind people around the world.
Professor McLaren, we'd like to know how the retinal implant developed by Retinal Implant works.
The retina implant can be thought of a bit like the film at the back of a digital camera. So it's a flat structure that has within it light-sensitive cells, similar to pixels in a camera. And these cells are activated by light, and then the implant itself stimulates the overlying retina so that patients are aware of a visual sensation when light strikes the back of their eye.
Are there other retinal implants being developed? Do they work differently?
Yes, the implant technology has been developed quite significantly over the last 20 years. And probably a lot of that advance has been due to the advances in electronics and making things very small, making devices very light sensitive and with relatively low power consumption. Perhaps the first significant advance was made with an implant that sits in front of the retina. This retina, known as an epiretinal implant, stimulates the nerve fibers that leave the eye and is connected to a camera outside the eye. So when the camera picks up an image, it processes the image and then the image is sent to the nerve. And then the patients who see this image, they have to learn how to analyze it and what it means. And the camera device has shown that patients can actually use the electronic retina fairly independently to some extent and at least get some useful benefit out of it. Now, one of the drawbacks of the camera device, of course, is that one needs to have a camera on one's head, and that can have certain practical limitations. An obvious thing is when you move the eyes around, it's a natural thing to move the eyes around to look for something. But if you have a camera, one has to move the head, and it's a little less obvious how to do that. The implant developed by Retina Implant has a slightly different approach, and it's a little bit closer to the real sort of vision that we would have in the eye, in that the actual implant itself is embedded within the eye and is light sensitive. So the implant has the role both of the camera and the electrode. It senses the light and it stimulates the retina. And the fact that it moves inside the eye as the eye moves is a much more natural perception for patients, because as they look up and down an image, the image will move on the implant, which wouldn't necessarily be the case with an epiretinal implant. So that's the way the sort of the technology has progressed. And I think broadly one could distinguish implants into those that sit in front of the retina and those that sit behind the retina. What we'd like to see in future would ideally be a system perhaps where An implant is underneath the retina and actually is completely self-powered, doesn't require any sort of power supply, and yet can sense light and stimulate the retina. At the moment, we are constrained by simple laws of physics in that there isn't enough energy in photons to actually generate the signal required to stimulate the retina. So we try to find a way around that. And the way Retina Implant have done that with their implant is to have an additional power supply which comes in through an electrode which is under the skin, transmitted via a magnet behind the ear, and that's how the device is powered.
What patients do you think might be helped by this sort of implant?
Well, that's again something that we're very keen to explore in our clinical trial. There are two real ways of looking at this. In the first instance, we want to know what kind of patient might actually see something with the implant. Now, in that regard, you know, we have to screen our patients very carefully before we do the operation. The implant is in the eye, and the eye is connected to the brain via the optic nerve. So if a patient has a disease of the optic nerve, such as glaucoma, or maybe has lost the optic nerve from trauma or some other damage, then no matter what you do to the retina, it's very unlikely the patient will see anything again. Mm. Similarly, if a patient has an injury to the brain and has a cortical form of blindness, then clearly the implant will not work for them. So the kind of patient we need are the patients who have lost all of their photoreceptors, but in whom the eye is relatively unaffected otherwise. Typically, patients with retinitis pigmentosa, which is a condition that affects approximately 1 in 3,000 people in the UK, and is actually increasing, the prevalence is increasing. So the thing about retinitis pigmentosa is it's a relatively clean loss of the light sensing rods and cones. The other layers of the retina, which include bipolar cells and the optic nerve cells, they remain relatively healthy even until late stages of disease. So we can put in the implant into a network where the signals and impulses will then be transmitted back to the brain where they can be processed. The other thing with the implant that we're looking at in terms of the kind of patients is that we're still dependent upon the cornea, the lens, to focus the light onto the back of the eye, onto the retina. So we need to be sure that the patients don't have any abnormalities or of the optical clarity or anything in the media which would prevent the images from getting through. And you know, we have to refract the patients and make sure that they can have a focused image in order to get the best use out of the implant. So anyone, for instance, who has, you know, corneal disease, for instance, who may have corneal scarring would not be suitable, although these patients may be more suitable for something that involves an external camera where one wouldn't be dependent on the eye itself to see anything. So the final thing we do is when we see patients, we're very keen to know and to know for sure that the optic nerve is functioning, even though the patient might not perceive any light. We pass a small current through the cornea, and this device simulates the sort of power that would go into the retina from the implant. And when we pass this current through at various intensities and various frequencies, we ask the patients what they can see. And if they have a sensitive retina or a sensitive optic nerve, they should see flashes of light. And by verifying that they can see flashes of light at the correct power setting, we have a very good indication that if we put the implant in, which provides the same level of power, that they'd be able to perceive something. If, however, we find that for whatever reason the patient is unable to see any flashing, even with a relatively high power supply, then again we wouldn't really find those patients suitable. So anyway, what I've sort of explained is who would be suitable in terms of the sort of the biology of their retina and the type of retinal degeneration. I think the other thing to think about, which is true of any clinical trial, is to have people who have realistic expectations about what they're getting involved with. So what we're not talking about is giving someone fantastic bionic vision. So, you know, like Superman, they can go around seeing infrared or seeing through buildings. You know, we're not doing anything like that. It is often referred to as the bionic eye because it is a combination of electronics which augments what is already there, but it's by no means an improvement over normal vision. It's still very, very poor vision that patients will have. But we would argue it's better than nothing at all. So we need to be sure that patients have a realistic expectation of what they're getting involved with, and we need people who are going to work with us in partnership to develop the research. We're doing a clinical trial, not a clinical treatment, and that brings with it many unknowns. The only way we can develop the technology further is by doing these clinical trials, and particularly by working with people who have the courage to accept that they are working with us to help develop the technology. They're not going to have a sudden instant cure for their blindness. It's going to be still a long way away from having anything close to what the vision they had was before.
What sorts of things have the patients been able to appreciate once they've had the implant?
Well, we have experience from patients who've been involved with the first part of the study, which has been in Germany, and I've met several of these patients and been over there to attend the surgery on more than one occasion. And the sort of thing that patients describe are being able to recognize shapes, being able to distinguish objects. One patient was able to see the change in facial expression in his partner, and was able to know when she was smiling and not. Another patient, several actually, have been able to read letters using the implant. Now, by reading the letters, we get a fairly good idea of what the sort of visual acuity is in a more technical term, but the reality is that we don't go around every day doing a daily task looking at large white letters on a black background. Okay, so it's a very artificial task in terms of sort of normal daily living. What we do is we want to know if there's a cup in front of us, is the cup half full, is it empty, there's a plate, where is the knife and fork? These are the sorts of things that we're assessing and that have been assessed before in Germany. And patients, in many cases, are able to recognise these objects and use them, as one would expect. And I have a particularly memorable video shown to me by Professor Joanna, who's the professor leading the research in Germany, of a patient sitting outside a typical German restaurant in Tübingen on a very hot day, with a nice cool glass of lager sitting in front of him, able to reach out with his hand and grab the glass. And I think that's perhaps a great incentive for us all of what might be achievable.